Okay. I have a very unrealistic aim to actually get through all of this before Shavuos. So what I might do is do this a little differently and not necessarily learn every pasuk in Shul. Maybe we'll part of the time just like talk outside while following the Pesukim. I could try to at least aim for that, and then maybe we'll finish half of it.
Give me something else first.
That's true.
Right.
Maybe I'll do that. Okay. Ruth. So, first of all, who wrote Ruth? Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi authored Ruth. Which gives us an inkling of its importance. But if we'll just talk in a general way, what's the significance of Megillas Ruth? Megillas Ruth, it's the whole story of Ruth, and it's providing the background of David HaMelech, right? That's how Sefer Ruth ends. The idea being, in a very general way, just given many different explanations of why Ruth warranted being recorded, that David HaMelech turned himself, we talked about this at length when we learned the sugis of David HaMelech back in the day, but David HaMelech was one of those stars on the scope of our history who mamish turned himself from a person into an eternal, I don't know if he used the word concept or value, what's that? Symbol, entity, an eternal entity of Klal Yisrael, meaning there's a Beit HaMikdash, right? It's not just an edifice, but it's an eternal entity, right? David HaMelech became that. Malchus Beis David became imprinted in the destiny of Klal Yisrael as something eternal. It's part of the system of what Klal Yisrael is, right? There's Torah. I'm not saying Malchus Beis David is Torah, okay? But besides Hashem, there are certain things that are the framework of what our people are, right? There's Torah, there's Eretz Yisrael, right? There's Beis HaMikdash, and there's Malchus Beis David. David HaMelech turned himself into that through the man he was. That's very, very big. We discussed it when we learned it at length. I'm not going to go into it now, but this warranted retroactively going back and bringing into Kisra HaKodesh. Once we had David HaMelech, so now we went back retroactively and we put into Kisra HaKodesh the background of David HaMelech, the inception of the David HaMelech, the creation of David HaMelech, and that's why Ruth, Shmuel HaNavi came along and put Ruth into the picture.
I mean, that's the thing. Shmuel was going to live like he died, like very shortly, before David even came king.
Shmuel died before David came king, but he anointed him.
All this transformation really happened.
All the stories?
All this transformation to David and Matt becoming this iconic figure and symbol was really something which happened after Shmuel died.
It came out Lapoyal after Shmuel died. But it was there,
potential.
It was there. And on the contrary, when Shmuel anointed David, the statement was already there that David was the future of Klal Yisrael. Okay. Now, why it's read on Shavuos? Why do we read it on Shavuos? So that, we'll just say in a general way right now, and as we move through it, Bezos Hashem, we'll see more and more. But in a general way right now, if we just want to talk on the most basic technical level, Shavuos is about Kabbalah Sateira. The story of Ruth is about Kabbalah Sateira on a personal, private level. Right? Just like the Jewish people went through the process of Gerus in a way when they were at Har Sinai, she went through the process of Gerus and entered the fold. But it's more than that. What's that?
You said you started earlier, and you also shaved me a little bit more.
What? Yeah, but not Malchus Beis David. Malchus Beis David as in David. Right? David was Yehuda. Yehuda had Malchus, right? But David as in David was its own Bria. It wasn't just Yehuda. But the truth is, it's more than just that there's a parallel to this Kabbalah Sotero. There's a very, very powerful point being brought out in terms of what Kabbalah Sotero means. But you know what? We'll leave that and we'll see it mamash as we begin. Begin, and then it's going to be a recurring thing as we move through. So, Rus is really the story of Rus. But it begins with a preface to the story, which is something of a side point, but we're going to give it its attention anyways, because there's a lot to learn from it. So, Vayehi b'mei Shvoyta Shoyftim, Vayehi ro'al v'oretz. This happened in the time of the judging of the judges. What period was this? So the generally accepted Shita Chazal is that this was in the period recorded in Shoftim as Ivtzon. Boaz was the Shofet Ivtzon. We might call that the main understanding in Chazal. There are other Midrashim. We'll just mention it for the interest's sake. There are other Midrashim. Some say that this occurred in the days of Ehud and Shamgar. Okay, so Shamgar is another is a shofet that we really know very, very little about. Then we have another little bit of color to add to our story of Shamgar.
So that would then make it that they lived very long. Ovid and Yishai, because that was very early.
It brings it further back. Right, I guess.
Depending on the root being the grandfather.
That's right. This would make that easier to understand. According to the understanding that Pius was Ibsan, we say granddaughter is Avdavka. She was a descendant of Balak.
Relative to the time they entered Eretz Israel, what year would this be?
If it was Ehud, she was the third Shefet. It was Yeshua, Osniel, and then Ehud. Pretty shortly after. Others say that it happened in the time of Zvaira and Baruch, but okay, that's really just parenthetical. Lemaisa, the main day is that this was what's recorded in Shoftim as Ivtzon toward the end of the Shoftim. This was Boaz was that Shoftim. Okay. Now, Vayidu Mesh Poita Shoftim. In the time of the judging of the judges, there was a famine. Bayelech Ishmu Beislechem Yehuda. And a man from Beis Lechem Yehuda went Lagur b'stei mayel to dwell in stei mayel. Oh, look at my boy. To dwell in the fields of mayel. Hu v'ishto u'shnei banav. He and his wife and his two sons. This is very the picture that this pasuk is describing is very very problematic. We don't appreciate. We hear someone moved out. We don't realize that in those days this was something that was entirely unheard of. There was just simply no such thing. And on the contrary, some of the Farshim say that the Pasuk is bringing this out by saying that there was a famine that was all across Eretz Yisrael, and there was one man who moved out. Okay? There was no such thing. The Jewish people dwelt together, they lived together. And there are two main understandings in Chazal, which probably come together. We're probably not going to spend too much time on that, of why it was that this whole family was punished. One of the understandings is the simple fact that he left Eretz Yisrael. Now let's understand that. So Chazal say, "Ador Eretz Yisrael to Mishayish Le'Elika." Right? Person who lives in Eretz Yisrael, it's like he has a Hashem. Person who lives in Chutz Haaretz, it's like he doesn't. Now let's understand, this is not just Gzeras HaKosim, it's not Gzeras HaKosim. According to the Ramban, the famous Ramban that talks about the spiritual aspect of that, but I don't want to focus on that now, I want to focus on the more material aspect, understanding of this statement of Chazal. And it is that it's a very, very practical point. Klal Yisrael lives in a very, very different reality than the rest of the world. The extent to how different the reality is, we don't appreciate today, because we're not living that sterile reality. We were born after 2,000 years of being among the nations, right? We lived among the nations. we don't appreciate how far we are from a sterile environment that is completely permeated exclusively by Jews and Judaism. I say Jews and Judaism because the Eretz Yisrael is full of Jews. It's not necessarily full of Judaism. We cannot say that the reality in Eretz Yisrael is characterized by Judaism exclusively, very unfortunately. But in those great days, when there was no other reality, and going to chutzpah, it's meant that you were leaving that, and there was nobody outside, there was nobody there, it meant that you were going off on your own, amputating yourself from Klal Yisrael, and amputating yourself from the sterile environment that Hashem intended in keeping having the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, and the atmosphere that permeated Eretz Yisrael then. We might discuss that comparison. But on the contrary,
there's no sterile environment, exactly, that's what
a number of the Mepharshim say. The big difference was exactly that. Avraham Avinu was not leaving the environment of Eretz Yisrael. Avraham Avinu was the environment of Eretz Yisrael. That's all there was, right? Which, okay, really behooves us to appreciate just this value of what it means to be living among from Jews. If you see the Rabbi Miller pamphlets that come out to put out every week, the Torah Samidya pamphlets, so last week's, he makes a very, very big deal about Batei Arei Chaima. You see that in many areas, there's special kedusha to a walled city. But a walled city is a permanent, concentrated area. A permanent, concentrated area of Jews has greater kedusha than other areas. You know, Yerushalayim, besides the kedusha of Yerushalayim, any walled city has its own standards of kedusha. Why? Because a permanent, concentrated area of Jews, you're not going to make a walled city until it's densely populated enough, and until it's permanent enough, right? So once you have such an area, Hashem cherishes it, and it moves into its own league.
That's not really true. The difference about the Arei Choma, it's not considered a Arei Choma if the wall has to precede the settlement.
What's that?
The wall has to come first. They're counterintuitive.
Yeah, but it's you're not going to make the wall and then see what's going to happen later. Obviously, there's a certain intent.
So maybe the other way, someone says, I'm going to sponsor, I want a ghetto to come with his dream, and then everybody files in.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the sort of thing.
Yeah. Perhaps it's to encourage it. And on the contrary, he says that that's the pshat of the Batei Arei Chaima, a house in a walled city. If you sell it, you have a year to get it back. If you don't buy it back within a year, use it forever. There's no yoivo, right? There's no yoivo. But Noah said that Torah is conveying, do not sell a house in a walled city. You want to sell a house in a suburb? Mela. You want to sell a farm for a shtickle tzufa? Mela. A house in a walled city, don't sell, don't leave it. And therefore he went on to say, you live in an area where you walk through the streets on Friday afternoons, and the street is streaming with little Jewish boys and girls, right? And you pass by a girls' high school, and it's a group of 30 girls walking with sneer-sticky dress in the summertime. And people are rushing to buy Shabbos, and you have to realize that you're living in Kedusha. Don't say I don't like ghetto life. Ghetto life, that is something that Hashem very, very much cherishes and loves. So now, this is really the point here.
That it will be spread out over a wider area where people are not plunged.
But that,
I'm saying you could have that same mitzvahs in a wide area. Why do you have to plunge them into a small area? You could have girls running around, you know, getting ready for Shabbos.
Okay, I'm done. We're not going to get into it. We'll put it this way.
They're running out of houses in Flatbush, and people go into five towns, and that's exactly what he's talking about.
He said that in the pamphlet. But you know what? Okay, we'll leave it at that. Take the idea and apply it. Okay? But this is really the point that's being made here. That's the sacrilege of moving out of Eretz Yisrael. You're moving out of a reality, of an atmosphere, of an environment where the values in the air, where the whole reality is just standards of Hashem. So he moved out. Why did he move out? Chazal tell us that he was a wealthy man, and as the famine was getting worse, people were starting to bang down his door because he had means. and he thought it was going to be too much. So he left. He left, figuring they're just going to be out for a short while. Lagur, the Malbim stresses. So it's Lagur. Lagur has a temporary connotation. And Bistei Mayav. On the contrary, he kept away from their city. But he stayed in the suburbs. He stayed out of town. Stay Mayav, in the fields of Mayav. Okay, not in the cities. He didn't mean to move into Mayav. He wanted to just park somewhere for the meanwhile. Then he'll come back. Okay? Vashem Ha'ish Elimelech. His name was Elimelech. Vashem Ish Dagnomi. Vashem Shnei Bonov Machloin the Kilion Ephrosim. Son, the names of his sons were Machloin and Kilion. They were Ephrosim. Ephrosim simply means distinguished people. It doesn't mean from Shevet Ephraim. They were from Yehuda, as we just said. Mibes Lechem Yehuda. Vayavayu Stei Mayov. So they came to Stei Mayov. And then, Vayiyusham. But then they stayed there. They stayed there. Once they were there, they didn't go back so fast. It was Gishmak. They got away from the ghetto. And they were enjoying the open space. And it was nice to be by themselves, out of it, a little bit of a change of atmosphere. And they weren't rushing back. There was no urgency to get back.
Did anyone discuss why they gave the kids a heinous names?
What's that?
Why did they give the kids a heinous names when, like, I don't know. A nice name.
We have to know, we would have to see what the name actually came from. Presumably they had some idea for that. I don't know.
The famine was still over there.
What?
Wasn't the famine still on?
It turned into settling in a permanent way. Meaning this one massive off, constantly waiting to see what's going to be, when can we move back. But then there's a mindset that changes and says, you know what, then it's fine here.
But the famine was still on?
Meanwhile, it's still on. Yeah, it was still on. Now, Vayama Salimelech Ishnami. Salimelech died. This was Hashem's punishment to him. Vakishah he Ushneba now. And what survived now was she and her two sons. Now this would sound unthinkable to us. They married two Moabi girls. Shema Achas Orpa, Veshema Shenis Rus. One's name was Orpa and the other was Rus. Vayesh Musham to Esel Shani. And they were there for about 10 years. And no, they were not Megaya then, which is rather shocking. We have to bear in mind that, yeah, this sounds shocking. We have to bear in mind that we, again, on the one hand, like we said before, we're very contaminated coming at the tail end of 2,000 years of Golus. Even here in Eretz Yisrael. Here in Eretz Yisrael is also very, very much affected by the 2,000 years of Golus right now. But on the other hand, we have the benefit of, when we went to Golus in the first place, there were leaders and authorities there setting us up for survival in Golus. Right? They were bracing us. They were giving us the defenses we needed in order to be able to weather the Golus. And therefore, the fact that the Jews withstood, they did not mingle, they didn't intermarry, etc. And whatever interaction they had with the Goyim was done in a disciplined way, that is a very, very great monument to the ability of the leadership. Of course, for the Hashgacha also, right? But there's an element of the efforts that the Jewish people made to fortify themselves, to be able to withstand this reality of being out of Eretz Yisrael, being mixed with the Goyim. They didn't have this benefit. I'm sure that Elimelech, when he moved out to Maya, well, either he didn't think of it or he didn't dream that it would actually happen. But they were there, and you know, you settle into the realities. And I don't know what they actually look like at this point. Did they mamish become like Moabim? Apparently not. It does seem that they maintained their Jewish nature. But being in Moab did its thing. And they married Moabi girls without being Megayag. And the truth is that maybe it was even Pumkai, because at that point it wasn't even so clear if you were allowed to marry. You'll be Megaya her if you'd be allowed to marry her. This way it was kind of like just leaving it outside the realm of question.
Yeah. Can you repeat that again?
There was a big controversy as to whether you're allowed to marry a female Moabi convert. Right? You're allowed to marry a male Moabi convert, you definitely can. Now, later it was possible that you could, but at this point it still wasn't clear, and that's going to be a theme throughout the Sefer.
Which is not a convert, as you pointed out.
So they circumvented the problem, I think. They're not converts. But whatever it is, okay, this is what happened. So Chazal say two things. Exactly. Chazal mentioned two averus that this punishment came for. Either it was leaving Eretz Yisrael, or it was the fact that he was running away from having to support the Aniyim. So we have to realize that two things. A, in those days, right, this is not Beis Din punishing with Misa, but Hashem directly dealt with people according to the standards they would be expected to live up to. Okay? And then yes, Hashem decided that for him to have taken this step warranted this. But it's also more than that. It's even more than that. This was a major pirtza. He did something that was unheard of. There was no such thing as a Jew leaving the land of the Jews. There was no such thing as a Jew leaving the body of the Jewish people. Right? He went and did this. This is... And before I should make this point also, this was a major... It had a very negative effect. And it's a major milestone that nobody else did it either, right? So now... That's what he did. Ah, so you're saying that's the... I hear. Now Chazal add. Okay, let's see the next pasuk. By Amusu Gam Shnei and Machlin Mikilian. Machlin Mikilian, the two sons died as well. And she was now left by herself and the family. Her husband and both of her children had died. Now Chazal tell us that this didn't happen in one shot, and this also takes the edge off what you asked of Shlomo. Chazal say that we see later that Naomi came back impoverished. When he left Eretz Yisrael, he was a rich man. Hashem did this in stages. Warnings came. First, one thing after another, they started losing their possessions in stages. And they were expected to take the hint. When a person doesn't take the hint, he's inviting worse things. Therefore, we could also say that even if we wouldn't necessarily say directly that doing this would have warranted Misa, but a hint, and you don't get it, that's already inviting a worse punishment, even if that wouldn't have been deserved in the first place. Okay? So, they had one financial loss. Another one, he's still not waking up. It culminated with Misa. She alone is left. Chazal say that she was a tzaddikus, and she wasn't an enthusiastic participant in this whole plan. And she wanted to go back. She wanted to go back, but she submitted to her husband.
In the sons?
What's that?
In the sons?
So I guess as long as the sons were still there, she wasn't going to leave, which Lemaisa, the Mepharshim do say that that's the reason that she had to suffer these things.
Well, but the sons died also. Why did the sons die?
Well, the sons died for the same reason the father died.
They were expected to support their name, or they're like a part of the...
No. The fact that they stayed out here, and they not went and married Moabi girls, they were all a part of this big sin.
It says here that she's the one that married off the sons to these Moabi boys.
I would say that she married them off. Don't say that. That's what they married. They married them. I used to let Russia. They married and took wives. Okay. Now, let's make a point. And this is what we said before. This is a major part of the impact of Sefer Rus. It was predestined that Moav should be a part of the creation of Malchus Beis God, of the Melech HaMashiach. There's a lot of significance to it. If I want to sound more choshev, I'll say we can't get into it right now. If I want to sound less choshev, I'll say that it's over my head. But there's Kabbalah involved, etc., etc. And it was important that Moav, that the Malchus of Chal Yisrael encompass elements of life. Okay? I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not going to try to explain things that I can't explain. But it had to be a worthy candidate. It had to be a worthy candidate. And here, there's a woman named Ruth. Miami girl growing up. And she was a sincere seeker of truth. She was a girl of golden character. And she was a girl that Hashem set his sights on. He wanted her. He wanted her to be joined to the fold. And Hashem was actually going to go ahead and change the course of history in order to make it happen that she will ultimately be drawn into Klal Yisrael. And not only that, she'll enter Klal Yisrael as an anonymous, second-rate foreigner, and she'll be brought all the way up to the top. Ein HaMalchus, right, Chalek? Right next to Shlomo HaMelech. She was still alive when Shlomo HaMelech was king. The point being, and this is a major part of the point we said before, this is what we're being told on Shavuos. The title was given to Klal Yisrael as a whole. But Hashem is looking out to the individual who is looking for him. And the individual who is looking for him, Hashem will draw him close. Not only among the Jewish people, from the farthest of places, from the Tumah of Moab, there is a person who is the right queen. Hashem will manipulate history to bring that person close to him. And this is what happened with Ruth. And therefore, the story of Elimelech and Machlon in Kilian, they were being used by Hashem as the means of netting her in. This was Hashem's plan. He wanted Ruth to join the Jewish people. And they went out there. There was how on earth would a person who knows nothing about the Jewish people somewhere out there, how they end up joining the Jewish people? The answer is that Hashem sent a messenger to leave Eretz Yisrael in a very uncanny way and bring her in. If you remember, this is not the first time this happened in history. But Nehemiah, when did it happen previously? Rachel, right? Rachel was exactly the same story. A woman who saw the truth, wanted it, had no means of getting to it. So Hashem sent two people from the Jewish people to her house to draw her back. This is the story of Ruth, and this is the lesson that it carries. This is what we want to be studying on Shavuot. Hashem gave the Torah to the Jewish people, but this is a very, very personal invitation to each individual. If you're looking for me, I'm going to find you, and I'm going to bring you intimately close to me. I'm going to draw you close. Now, Eila, Moshe David Bali makes this point, and it says, if so, Elimelech, the whole family, this was really Hashem's plan. Right? On the contrary, he was saying that they were meant to go bring her back. So why are they being treated so harshly? So he says this very cryptically, but this is a point, a scary point that the Bali Musar expound on her, but there's another talks about this at length. Hashem will manipulate people's faults to serve his purpose in history, and they will come out loser on both ends. Because they're going to be putting in Hashem's hands, he's going to use them as puppets, and then they're going to be punished for the wrong that they do. Therefore, for example, a person, there's a few scary examples of this. Paro is a classic example. This was a guy who was a little too arrogant, felt that he could challenge Hashem. Hashem said, you know what, I'm going to put you in a position to really challenge me, and then I'm going to bring about the biggest Kiddush Hashem on your back, and you're going to end up decimated. Right? So, Paro's bad midas, Hashem worked it into his plan, and Paro ended up facilitating the greatest gilui kvod shamayim ever. Right? And this is what happened with Elimelech in a little bit of a smaller sense. And this is a scary thing. We have to constantly be working at our character flaws. Because if a person decides, one of our functions, and Avigdor Miller made it, would stress this point. One of the chief careers that we're here in this world for, the world talks about this, etc., is avodas hamidas, perfecting our midas. There's a whole array of midas that we have to be working to perfect. You don't have to be perfect, you can't be perfect, but you have to be working to perfect them. If a person has a character flaw, and he decides that he's at peace with it, he's complacent, he's fine with that, Hashem will send things to trip him up in that area, and it's going to go from being a character flaw to serious sins. It's going to get him into big trouble. This is what Hashem did to Doiga, Doimi, etc., etc. This is what happened with Elimelech also. There was a certain sense of, he was suffering from a certain sense of lack of a sense of affiliation. Call it feeling a little bit aloof from the rest of Klal Yisrael or whatever it is. Hashem said, feeling aloof from my people? You're feeling aloof from my people? I will present you with the opportunity and the circumstances that will draw you away from them. And, yes, it'll be to my convenience. That way I'll get loose in, but you'll be punished. Because of the fact that you had these traitor sentiments. Now, again, if a person has character flaws, you know what that means? That means that he's a person. That means that he's the person that Hashem wanted to create. Hashem wanted to create people with character flaws. There's no problem with having character flaws. The problem is being at peace with them. The problem is deciding that it's fine, I can leave it as is. If you know that you have a certain character flaw, and you're working at it, and it's a slow process, perfect. If you know they have a certain character flaw, but there are other things that require more urgent attention, fine. But if you decide, you know what, I'm okay with this, then you're setting yourself up for Hashem finding the means, providing the means, to trip you up specifically in that area. This is what happened to Elimelech. And yes, Hashem used it as his way of bringing Rusin to the Jewish people.
It's not exactly Avira Gorea Savera. This is the same. Avira Gorea Savera,
in a much subtler way.
You might not want it, but here you're open to it. You're open to
right,
it.
Right. I mean, you leave yourself vulnerable, it'll hit. Don't leave yourself vulnerable. Right, I guess that would be more than that very rare thing. Right.
They
don't show them what's later. Okay, so now let's move a little quickly now. So now she is now an impoverished widow after having been an aristocratic mother of a family. And she and her daughters-in-law got up and they started leaving Sde Mayav, fields of Mayav, because she heard that the famine was over in Eretz Yisrael. So she left and she's heading back with her two daughters-in-law. Now something subtle happens. Both of them are heading back with her. Both of them intend, Arpa and Rus, they both intend to go back with her. They're not going to leave her. But there was a subtle difference between... Why? Why? Because they were both enamored with what they saw. They both got to know her. Yes, these were people who had fallen in terms of the standards of Yiddishkeit. But these two Miami girls were very taken by the person that Naomi was, by the ideals she represented, by the ideals that this family held, and they were both determined to go back with her. But there was a bit of a difference between Orpah's admiration and Ruth's admiration. This is a subtle point. And the Mepharshim make this point, Alter Rav Kalman brings it out more. Arpa, and this is something to note, to be very relevant. Arpa was enamored with Naomi in terms of she thrived on the relationship. She felt that she grew from the relationship. She felt that it was a very, very rewarding relationship. But ultimately, you know what it was? It was Arpa on the receiving end. It was Arpa on the receiving end, and she cherished her relationship with Naomi because of what it did for her. And she was willing to live up to very high standards, and she was willing to make great sacrifices because of the benefit of having a relationship with Naomi. Ruth might have looked exactly the same, the two of them, but Ruth was something else. Ruth recognized the truth of this. Ruth recognized that this is what ought to be. And therefore she also wanted to be very close with Naomi. But the object of Ruth's drive wasn't Naomi. If it would have moved away Naomi out of the picture, her drive would have been there too. Because say, what Naomi lived with Emes, I have to be living this also. Not for the sake of my relationship with Naomi, not because it's unbelievable. Life is of a different quality if you live with a woman like Naomi, but because this is what I now understand is the only way that it's possible to live. Now, our thought might have been living at the same level and adhering to the same standards and willing to make the same sacrifices, but it was driven by what she was getting out of it. Very subtle difference.
So the Maestro did Hashem. We said before that Rus was the Chaim Kofa wanted what Rus had. The Chaim Kofa, they didn't had no interest in what Orpah had.
That's had true. And Adarav, this might be the difference.
This
might be the difference. Rus was the real thing. And Rus wanted it because of what it was. Right? She understood, now that she saw what Avodas Hashem is, she understood that there cannot be a life that's not a life of dedication to Hashem. And the issue wasn't Naomi. Naomi was a very great means to that. But that wasn't the object. So now, so Naomi told the two daughters-in-law, right, this is the classic halacha, many of Hilchos Gerus are based on this incident. She starts discouraging them, right, she starts trying to turn them off. Go back home. We've reached the end of our road. You did very great things for me. You achieved very great things. You've earned your schar. Hashem is going to be giving you much schar. And you don't need to do any more. I'm going back home. I'll be taken care of. You passed the test. You graduated. Now go back home and enjoy. Take it easy. And she says, Hashem will pay you all for all the chesed that you did with the dead and that you did with me. And she blesses them. Go back home. Get yourself married. Set yourself up for a good life. She kissed them, and they both wept. And they both said, they were both determined. They both said, no, we're going to come back with you, we're going back home with you. So Naomi says, no, go back home. Why are you going with me? I have nothing more to offer you. Listen to the message that she's telling you. She makes a convincing argument over the fact that I have nothing left to offer you. Okay? She says, you were so thrilled to have been married to my family. Do you think I'm going to have more children? I'm not going to have any more children, right? Even if I get married tonight and I have children tonight, you're going to wait around for them to mature. Forget about it. Forget about it. You don't have a future with me. So they raised their voices and they wept. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law a goodbye kiss. Meaning what? Again, she was a complete chassid of Naomi. That other film person. She was a complete chassid of Naomi and she trusted her implicitly. And if Naomi is telling her this isn't to die for you, she accepted. She accepted. And she left. And she gave up on her future. Virus Davkaba. But Rus clung to her. Because again, with Rus, what Rus was determined about was beyond Naomi. It wasn't about Naomi. It was about the emes that Naomi represented. And Rus had reached such a level of conviction, even if the Rebbe is telling me this isn't good for you, I cannot live any life other than this emes.
Why doesn't she get credit for some level of emunah sachamim that she had? B, whatever happened to or to the bracha that she gave her earlier, she goes back and right now she gets, you know, molested by 100 men and a dog.
Like, she wasn't molested. This might not even the fulfillment of the bracha in my avitur. She wasn't molested.
She was on the way back.
That was
a blessing?
In my terms. This is a beautiful fulfillment of the bracha. Ruth wanted the fulfillment of the bracha in Jewish terms. Once she went back, she had a lot of nachas from her goyas. In Moabi terms, this was a mother's dream. It was before the age of the Jewish doctor. Right? This was actually I shouldn't say it was the wrong nation, right? What is What does the African mother want to see? She wants to see her son be a basketball star. But she wanted to see him be a very great warrior. She had a lot of nachas. Right? Are you kidding? A whole bunch of sons with six fingers.
Six fingers, yeah. Yeah. Okay. He's grandson.
Oh, four giants.
Slam a basketball.
That's right. That's right. So now, Rus Dabkaba, but Rus Pantar. So now, Vatayna. So she said, Shava Yivin Techel Amo. Your sister-in-law has gone bad. She went back to her nation, Melele Hel. She went back to her gods. Shuvi Achei Yivinte. Go along with her. Why? What do you need this for? Vatayna Rus Al Tid Yibi. Do not, we'll just go with the simple understanding of this word. Don't keep pushing me. Don't convince me. Don't push me to leave you, to go back home. We're going to stop here. I mean, we're going to pause here. We're not going to go into the famous continuation of what was said. I want to first just focus on what we've seen up till here. So first of all, we're seeing the concept of discouraging converts, right? This is the basis for the concept. This is something that has to be noted because it's an outstanding characteristic of our faith. I don't know. I know that in the major religions it's certainly not like that. I don't know if we could say it's like that. Maybe you can tell us. Is there any other religion in the world that does not want and discourages adherence? What's that? Yeah, the Druze also don't? Okay.
They think they're from Yisrael.
Oh yeah, but this is a major monument to the Jewish people. Right? The Kuzari talks about this. But the Christians and the Muslims, it's one big membership drive after the major movement. In the Sefer HaKuzari, there's the debate between the Jewish Chacham and the king, right? And the king says the Jewish Chacham makes this whole argument about how the Jewish faith is based on our experiences with Hashem. Hashem revealed himself to us. And that's the basis. Without that, we wouldn't really have a basis to believe in him, etc. So the Khazari king comes and makes a claim that he thinks is like a knockout punch. He says, so if so, there's no basis to expect it of anybody else. And he thinks he's come with a knockout punch of the Jewish faith. If you're saying that it's based on your own national experiences, that you folks personally experienced Hashem, so that means that there's no room to convince other people, because they didn't have that experience. So the Jewish Chacham says, exactly. We're not looking to convince anybody. We have no need for it. We're not interested in it. That's right. And that is shocking to the Khazari king is very startled by that, because that went against his concept of any faith. Right? But this is the point. We don't need it. We are established. We are who we are. And we're not looking for that. So that makes a big deal about that in terms of it being a monument to the integrity of our faith. It's a part of our Masaira. We were never trying to pull anybody in from the outside. It was all built from within and maintains that. What's that? That's a different story. That's expected of every person. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're saying all we're not looking for converts, all the Goyim will accept Hashem?
Yeah. That's not through our efforts. Not through our direct efforts. And ultimately, everyone will come to that recognition. We're waiting for that day. Now, one other point that we'll end with this is that David already mentioned the famous Chazal of that when Arpa went home. When Arpa went home, it wasn't like she said, okay, now she sat down and learned Musar and said, now what can I hold on to from this very great day? She went home and she said Chazal, she read she was with 100 men and a dog.
Willingly?
Yeah.
Good.
Why not? Did it say that? I don't remember it that way. I don't remember it that way. That's not how I remember it.
Or Pashi, or Pashi, or Pashi.
Kind of like...
Oh, it was Dungeon like Hidaka, the Seda. You know, we'll have to check it up again. That's not how I remember it. I didn't think of looking into that now.
He's going back, go do with your sister, go home, go back to your family and your God.
Your God.
So...
was an implication, she didn't have very high expectations.
Right.
Right. So Lamai said there are a couple of approaches given as to how that happened. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says that there's a Musar point that's very relevant that we have to take away from this. And again, he's obviously based on the understanding. I have to check this up again. He's obviously based on the understanding that no, this was part of the deterioration. It wasn't. But we'll check it out. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says this is something very relevant. When a person feels like a failure, they're liable to really get into it. She feels like she messed up now, so. Nothing's worth anything anymore. I can just drop all standards. And the truth is that sometimes, that's really where the test of a person's virtue lies. Sometimes, what you think is a failure is really the test of how strong are you? Are you capable of still aiming for the highest standards, even after you've already lost the perfect record? You've lost the perfect record. Now are you capable of aiming for the highest standards? And sometimes, if you do, you'll be reaching an even higher level than had you not had that failure in the first place. You following the mathematics? If you were working with the inspiration of have a perfect track record, right? You kept yourself going. Okay, you had a certain fuel. If you are able to lift yourself up when you got that blow of a failure and give that push, you might be reaching a lot higher than had you not had that failure in the first place. This David HaMelech epitomized that. David HaMelech epitomized that. What's that?
See, the psychology of love and your God together. You can come back.
Oh,
see,
exactly.
See both.
That's right. This is something very, very relevant. And you're talking about people who are off the derech, but it's relevant on a subtle level also to even if we're not going off the derech. But Jonathan is saying this is a very common phenomenon. You see, once a kid has a certain fall, everything quickly spirals after that. Right? Person at a certain point, he quickly spirals after that. That's this thing he's saying, that Chaim Shmulevitz says, was the story with Arpa here. As soon as they left, and she saw Rus go, I lost it. And therefore, she wasn't able to live the life of a virtuous guy that perhaps Naomi was trying to describe. Which is a madrega. It's a big madrega, right? A guy can be a very virtuous guy. But no. When she felt like a failure, she became a failure. Tzvi Meir Zilberberg makes a big deal about this. He talks about the special avoida of coming back after a fall. He talks about the special chavivus that Hashem has for such an avoida. That a person fell, and now he comes back. And he's not going to let himself get down by that. Hashem especially cherishes that avodah. In fact, he says that on a deeper level, that's the aside of the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, we all go into Rosh Hashanah feeling like it's a new start. Everything is going to be perfect. Every word of tefillah is going to be the kavanah, right? And then he says, and I'm not. How can you yell at my wife? I'm not going to yell at any of the kids. And you get halfway through the Sunnah, right? That's a feat. And then suddenly, in the middle of Musa, you find yourself, you're in Shaifaris, but you suddenly realize that you were spacing out. You miss Malchus, you miss Zechrainus, oh, forget it, Barfala. We'll talk again next year. The Tzvimer Zilberberg says, the second day is there for that. Hashem wants to give you the opportunity of Rosh Hashanah, not only of doing the first Mayrim, the first Shalchus in the best way possible, but the first rise after a fall. Hashem wants to see you do that perfectly in Rosh Hashanah too. That's part of your perfect record. To be able to rise after you fall. That's part of the perfection that Hashem wants to see. That's especially beloved to Hashem. And therefore, there's a round two of everything you do on Rosh Hashanah. There's a round two on the second day. Let's see the rise after the fall. Okay. We'll stop here. What's that? Pesach Sheni. Oh. Yeah, it does sound. Really.